Sabbath greetings to everyone on January the 16th. It's time to return to the book of Genesis. Today we'll cover two chapters, Genesis 36 and 37. We're not going to read chapter 36 word for word. It's the generations of Esau, as it says in verse 1. Now these are the generations of Esau, who is Edom. I can't pronounce these words correctly, and in this Bible study format, we're not going to read the list of names. This is book 10 in the book of Genesis. The book of Genesis is made up of 11 different documents, as we talked about in the introduction to the book of Genesis, and each one of them, except the first one, begins with, these are the generations of. It uses that phrase to begin a separate book. Now, they include chapter 36 as one book, even though in verse 9 it says, these are the generations of Esau. I mean, the first eight verses and then verses 9 through 36 or whatever it is, through, 43, are also about Esau, so they count this as one book. The first book doesn't use generations, it just uses in the beginning, and book 2 is not the generations of an individual, but the generations of the heaven and earth, and then it's Adam, and then Noah, and the sons of Noah, and then Shem, and so forth. And now we're down to the generations of Esau. We could ask ourselves the question, why is this chapter in the Bible about Esau? Well, Esau was one of the descendants of Isaac, who was the child of promise through a miracle for Abraham. And then Esau and Jacob were twin brothers. And even though Esau was not chosen by God to be his chosen people to work through, from a religious point of view, down through the ages, Esau still had a blessing coming as the son of Isaac. And this chapter is in the Bible in one sense to show the fulfillment of the promise made by God through Isaac to Esau. Even though Esau did not get the promise of the birthright that Jacob stole from him for a bowl of soup, nor did he get the blessing that Jacob got through deception by lying and pretending to be Esau. But Isaac still blessed Esau. And this chapter is to show that he had plenty of descendants just like Jacob did. Esau ended up with 12 sons, just like Jacob did. And it shows later on in the chapter that these sons, that a line of dukes or kings descended from him. So this chapter is to show that, Esau was not forgotten completely, that he did receive blessings, just not the same magnitude of blessings that Jacob did. Something that we should think about as we think about Esau. The first nine verses talk about the wives of Esau, and the commentaries talk about how the names for these wives don't match up with the names that are given earlier in this book of Genesis for his wives. But it was common back then for them to have more than one name and to be called by more than one name. It also seems apparent, there's no definite proof. The most authorities on these topics come to the same conclusion that one of Esau's wives, maybe his first wife, I'm not sure, I don't remember, did die at an earlier age, and you know, he had several wives, I think three or four, maybe four or five, I forget which, and that one of them died, but I think he had like four wives, just like Jacob had four wives, and he had 12 sons, just like Jacob had 12 sons. And then we read verses 6 and 7. And Esau took his wives and his sons and his daughters and all the persons of his house and his cattle and all the beast and all his substance which he had got in the land of Canaan and went into the country from the face of his brother Jacob. So he went to Seir, the land of Seir, which was not in the land that we refer to or think of as the land of Palestine, the land of Judea, west of the Jordan River in that territory. So he had great wealth and an abundance of people and sons and daughters and cattle and servants and people in his household. To where I think Josephus tells us, but it becomes apparent that, you know, Isaac was still alive at this time, even though we talked about his death earlier. Most of the wealth of Isaac was going to go to Jacob, and yet Esau had some of the wealth. And apparently, you know, some of that wealth came from Isaac. Isaac didn't give everything to Jacob. He divided it up, maybe, who knows, maybe with two-thirds of it going to Jacob and one-third of it going to Esau. But notice that Esau, it indicates here that he left the area voluntarily, that he deferred to his younger brother, even though his brother was, you know, they were twin brothers, and they were just separated in birth by, you know, minutes. It seems like Esau had accepted that Jacob, through God's will, Jacob was to receive the firstborn rights and the blessing. And even though he did it wrong, that it was God's will. And, you know, I would imagine that after Jacob left for 20 years, that Isaac and Esau had discussions about what had happened, about what Jacob had done, and about what God had told Rebekah, that the younger brother, that the older brother would serve the younger brother. And I would imagine they had discussions about that and what God's will was. And that, kind of reading between the lines, we can kind of assume that Esau came to accept that. Now we, as it goes on to say in verse 7, for their riches were more than that they might dwell together, and the land wherein they were strangers could not bear them because of their cattle. And so there wasn't enough land or grazing land for all of the cattle for all of them. And so it seems like Esau volunteered to leave the area, to go to another area. And again, as we said, he defers not only to his younger brother, but he moves to a less fruitful area. The area that he moved to wasn't as green. It didn't have as much natural water as far as the ability to take care of the cattle. It wasn't as good as the land in which Isaac and Jacob are going to remain. So history, again, through Josephus and other records and just reading between the lines, Esau turned out apparently to be a decent and honest man. He was just not chosen for the same purpose as Jacob. And, you know, we think of Jacob, or we think of Esau as a bad person a lot of times. And there's really, well, you know, there's some reason for that. When Jacob stole the blessing from him, Esau did say he was going to kill him. And certainly that wasn't his greatest moment. But if we'd have been rooked out of a fortune, we might be pretty angry at the person that did that too. And we might say something like, I'll get even with that person. And, you know, maybe Esau really meant it. And apparently he did, that maybe he mellowed or even repented of that later on. Who knows? And, of course, we have the New Testament scripture where it says that, you know, he gave away his birthright. He didn't value it as much as he should have. And then maybe the main reason we think of Esau as a bad individual is because of his descendants and all the fighting that the descendants of Esau are the Turkish people and some of the Arab tribes. And they're at war with the primarily the Jews, one tribe of Israel. And therefore we think, well, Esau was like that too. And there's really no evidence to support that. We see that when Esau greeted his brother, you know, that he hugged him and they cried over each other in reunion. And it seems like in the last couple chapters that they're getting along. And they both, we read earlier, they both come together to bury their father with no animosity. And here we seems there seems to be an agreeable solution to the problem of too much cattle in one area. So maybe we need to rethink our view of Esau. Again, he wasn't chosen by God like Jacob was, that the promise of race and grace, the grace of the Savior was to come through Jacob and then through the tribe of Judah, and the promise of race, that through all the, you know, all the world would be blessed, you know, by the 12 tribes of Israel, but mainly through the tribe of Joseph and Ephraim and Manasseh. The promises of race and grace were to go to Jacob and not Esau. But that doesn't mean that Esau was a bad person. You know, just like today, there are many good people, but not all of them are chosen to understand the truth. At this time, before the second coming of Jesus Christ and the first resurrection, just a small group are going to make it into the first resurrection. But everyone will have an opportunity to be in the family of God and the kingdom of God at some later time. So again, verse 9, we see these are the generations of Esau, the father of the Edomites in Mount Seir. These are the names of Esau's son, Eliphaz, the son of Ada. Some think that you know, one of the friends of Job was Eliphaz, and some think that it was this individual here in verse 10, but that seems very unlikely. It seems more likely in verse 11, and the sons of Eliphaz were Teman, Omar, and so forth. It says in Job chapter 2, verse 11, that Eliphaz the Temanite was a friend of Job. And here the son of Eliphaz, the son of Esau, Teman became the father of the Temanites, of whom Eliphaz was a friend of Job. And oh, let's see here. One other thing I wanted to point out, and I didn't mark it. There's, where is that? Somewhere in here. Oh, I'll have to, shame on me for not marking that. One of the sons mentioned here is Joab, J-O-B-A-B or something like that, and my eye doesn't fall on it. Some think that that might have been another name for Job. And, you know, Esau did know the true God. It doesn't say that he worshipped pagan idols or anything. We don't know what his religious preferences were. And I'm still looking for that. 33. Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah, oh, I did mark it. That's just later in the chapter than I thought it was. Okay, we'll come to that, verse 33. Down in verse 20, these are the sons of Seir the Horite who inhabited the land. There seems to be, you know, Esau married one of the daughters of his uncle, Ishmael. And there's a kind of a combining of the tribes or the peoples of Esau, the Horites, the Seirites, and a couple of these peoples from different families, different heritages through marriage ended up kind of becoming a family unit, and it talks about verses 17 through 19, the dukes. And the dukes, and Esau and his sons took a primary position over these people and led them, and they were called dukes. Okay, and then it talks about again the dukes and their names, and we come down to verse 31. And these are the kings that reigned in the land of Edom before there reigned any king over the children of Israel. Well, obviously, if you think about it, this verse had to be added after there were kings in Israel. So this is an editorial comment that was could not have even been added by Moses, who put together these books. But we need to remember that, Ezra played a primary purpose in canonizing the Old Testament, and the 70 elders. Ezra and 70 elders did most of the work in determining, you know, through the inspiration of God, finalizing, you know, maybe not every single last book, but, you know, pretty much deciding which books were to be in the inspired Old Testament and which ones were not. And as they put together these books, every now and then they would put in some editorial comments to identify to the current readers, you know, either a location by a different name, you know, between when it was first written and between the current readers, or a comment like this, and just to say that, you know, the descendants of Esau were kings that reigned in Edom over the different peoples, again, the Horites and some of the descendants of Ishmael and the descendants of Esau, that they were kings or dukes before there were any kings over the children of Israel. And then we see in Bela the son of Beor reigned in Edom, and the name of the city was Dinhaba. And Bela died, and Jobab, the son of Zerah, reigned in his stead. Some think that this might be Job, but there's no proof that it's another name for Job. But it would, you know, it would make a certain amount of sense. You know, Job knew God. He knew the true God. So how did he know that? And his friends were descendants of maybe Esau, or at least one of them were. So there might be you know, there's some possibility to that. The other interesting thing about this is that these dukes, and then in the last couple verses of the chapter, where it lists the dukes one after another, there were 12 dukes, and then there were a line of dukes, that these were not descendants. None of them are mentioned. It just says that someone else reigned in his stead. And apparently these dukes were elected. And that there was a council of like 12. And that when the leading one would die or something like that, then they would elect a new one. Yeah. You know, maybe not a democracy, so to speak, but it wasn't through birthright that these dukes they were chosen. They were chosen through some type of a consensus. All right. So now we're ready for chapter 37. And Jacob dwelt in the land wherein his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. If we look, it says, where it says, wherein his father, it means of his father's journeys. Somewhere there's a translation where it says they were strangers in a strange land. And that was the title of a science fiction book, too. You know, they dwelt in the land of Canaan, but they weren't the original descendants until, you know, actually until they came back from Egypt, and they took it by force through God's permission, and not permission, but his God's directive. God said, this land is yours, even though there are other people dwelling in it. These are the generations of Jacob, verse 2. So this is book 11. And in one sense, the rest of the Bible is now about the descendants of Jacob, if you think about it. You know, in the strictest sense, the rest of the book of Genesis is about the descendants of Jacob. But the rest of the Bible is about Israel. And the rest of the Old Testament, it's Israel. And when we have prophecies or the other nations or peoples, it's all relative to their interaction with Israel. And the New Testament is about Israel, but in this case, spiritual Israel. Now, spiritual Israel started out primarily as Jews, the physical Israel, but we know from the writings of Paul that anyone who accepts Jesus Christ as the Savior and obeys the commandments of God becomes a spiritual Jew or a spiritual Israelite. Or as Apostle Paul says, anybody can be grafted into the tree of Abraham, the tree of Israel, and become a descendant of Abraham. And not just a descendant of Abraham, but Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Those being the three that God worked through and chose. And through Jacob, again, the promises of race and grace. But all can be grafted into that tree. So again, in that sense, the rest of this Bible is about the generations of Jacob, both physically in the Old Testament and spiritually in the New Testament. And we're going to concentrate quite a bit on the story of Joseph. Now, we all have our favorite stories in the Bible, and I think my favorite story, without question, is the story of Joseph. I mean, I like the story of David and Goliath, and all of those stories, and Daniel and the lion's den, all of the Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Those are all great stories. But if we have a personal favorite, which is okay, my personal favorite is the story of Joseph. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brethren. the original Hebrew here says he was over the flock, and some think that Jacob had put Joseph, had made Joseph as the chief shepherd over part of the flock. It doesn't specifically state that, but even though Joseph was the youngest son, except for Benjamin. Benjamin was at this time between 1 and 4 years old. So Benjamin was not in the picture yet as far as having any capability or, you know, any status as an adult and being able to work. And with his brethren, and the lad was with the sons of Bilhah and with the sons of Zilpah. Well, the reason for that is the sons of Leah were far older than he was, and he was closer, Joseph was closer in age. He was younger, but still closer in age to the two sons of Bilhah and the two sons of Zilpah. So apparently the five of them had responsibility over, you know, not all of the flocks of Jacob, but, you know, one of his large flocks, and his father's wives, and Joseph brought unto his father their evil report. Well, we're not told what they were doing wrong, whether they were, you know, getting into trouble, or whether they were just not good shepherds and not taking care of their responsibilities as they should. We have no idea. But the indication is, and I think, you know, other, again, I don't know, Josephus and other historians indicate that Joseph, even at a young age, was a very responsible person, more so than his brothers, which caused problems with his brothers. There were several things here that we'll read that caused problems between Joseph and his brothers. Now, Israel loved Joseph more than all his children because he was a son of his old age. Again, because Benjamin was so much younger, it's like he doesn't count yet, so to speak. And he made him a coat of many colors. Now, if we look in the margin, that says pieces. And the actual Hebrew kind of means many breadths, a wide coat. The word colors is not really used here. It means a coat of many pieces. Colors is implied. More importantly, the coat was a long coat with long sleeves and that came down to the ankles. And it was a coat that was made of different pieces of cloth, and the pieces of cloth were of different colors. In the artist's conceptions of Joseph, it's always a nice, neat coat with parallel stripes, you know, up and down of the same width, and that's probably not likely. But this type of coat was only worn by royalty, or people of importance and great wealth, or the daughters of wealthy individuals. And so, you know, here's a problem. Jacob made a mistake, and it caused problems in his family by showing preference for one son over the other. And even though, even if that son was better behaved, you can't do that with your children, obviously. But because it was, you know, he had four wives, and this was the son of his favorite wife, and so he showed, you know, even if you do kind of have a preference, you can't show it. That's obviously, but he did. And of course, these two things, the other 10 brothers of Joseph could see that Jacob loved Joseph more than them, and they could see that, you know, he got this very expensive, prestigious coat to wear, and so they were jealous of that and not happy about it. And when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brethren, they hated him and could not speak peaceably unto him. You know, the normal greeting, you know, today among the Jews, the normal greeting is shalom. And they had the same greeting or a similar greeting back then, that when you met somebody, you know, the greeting was not hello, but it was peace. And that's what shalom means. And his brothers could not say that to Joseph. When they met him, they could not say anything nice to him, even in greeting. They wouldn't say hello or, you know, peace be unto you or everything is well with you. And they just couldn't say anything nice to Joseph. They were so upset and jealous about this. And to make things matters worse, and Joseph dreamed a dream, and he told it his brethren, and they hated him yet the more. And he said unto them, hear, I pray you, this dream which I have dreamed. Now, we kind of get the impression that Joseph at this time is not all that humble. He seems to be rather pleased to be the favorite son of his father, and he wears his coat wherever he goes, it seems like. And, you know, as it kind of says here in verse 6, when he has this dream, he seems fairly anxious to tell his family, his brothers, about this dream. You know, it says, here, I pray you, this dream which I have dreamed. For behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and lo, my sheaf arose and also stood upright, and behold, your sheaf stood round about and made obedience to my sheaf. So the meaning of this is fairly clear. And again, Joseph seems to be happy about that situation, almost like he's rubbing it in with his brothers. You know, you guys don't treat me right. But you're going to, in the, you know, the God has given me a dream that you're going to bow down and to serve me. And I will have authority over you or something like that. Now, this dream shows their current situation. You know, part of taking care of the sheep was, you know, they had to gather food for the sheep in the summertime for the winter when there wasn't the grass to feed them and to take care of them. And they were involved in these activities of gathering hay. And so this shows kind of Joseph as an individual was going to be over his brothers. Verse 8, and his brethren said to him, shall you indeed reign over us? So they understood what this implied. Or shall you indeed have dominion over us? And they hated him yet the more for his dream and for his words. You know, it's not only his dream, but it was that he told them about it, and probably how he told them and how he said it. And he dreamed yet another dream, and he told it his brethren and said, behold, I have dreamed a dream more, and behold, the sun and the moon and the 11 stars made obedience to me. And he told it to his father and to his brethren. And as notice, it doesn't say his mother, because Rebekah was dead, and Leah. If Leah was not dead, you know, she died before they all left and went down to Joseph in Egypt. And his father rebuked him and said unto him, what is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall I and your mother and your brethren indeed come to bow down ourselves to you in the earth? So Leah may have been alive at this time, but she died between now and when they went down to Egypt. And the other two wives, Bilhah and Zilpah, were younger wives as the handmaids. They were probably much younger. And we're still alive. So it's kind of, you know, in general, that the mother and father and brothers, you know, the whole family, were going to bow down to him. Two dreams means that, you know, the emphasis is this really is going to happen. But the second dream can be implied a little differently when it talks about the stars and the moon and the sun. some of the commentaries think that whereas the first dream was more of an individual, the sheaves bowed down to the other sheaf, Joseph's sheaf. Here is the sun and the moon and the stars made obedience to him. Some think that this is more of the tribes of Israel, that the 11 tribes, you know, in the future, not only would the 12 brothers or the 11 brothers, you know, bow down and do obedience to Joseph, and Joseph would be ruler over the land of Egypt, second under Pharaoh, but that in the future that the tribes of Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh, would be the leading tribes in Israel. And that was true. Ephraim and Manasseh took the leadership position, and sometimes Judah. And Ephraim and Manasseh ended up being the most physically blessed in this day and age of all of the tribes of Israel. But again, the promise of the Messiah came through Judah. Verse 11, and his brother envied him, and his father observed the saying. And he kept it in his heart and wondered, you know, what it meant. And his brethren went to feed their flock in Shechem. And Israel said unto Joseph, do not your brethren feed the flock in Shechem? Come, and I will send you unto them. And he said to him, here am I. Shechem is, you know, sometimes we forget these things, you know, and I do, and I don't always tie everything together, and that's one good thing about reading through the commentaries, you know, they catch everything. Shechem is a city where Dinah was raped, or, you know, taken by force maybe, or halfway willing, date rape, or whatever it might have been, and where Simeon and Levi went in and killed all the men, and they took the city captive. So Jacob might have been a little worried about, retribution. And so he wants to know how the sons of Leah are doing and taking care of the sheep and if everything's okay and in this area of the land where they had this problem in the past. And he said unto him, go, I pray you, see whether it be well with your brethren and well with the flocks, and bring me word again. So he sent him out of the vale of Hebron and came to Shechem. Shechem was about 40 miles away from Hebron. So Jacob had set up home base in Hebron, and there was more water and more pasture. Well, that's in Dothan. They had a lot of cattle, and they had to cover a lot of territory in order to find pasture and water for their huge flocks of cattle. So Joseph goes to find his brethren, and he can't find them. Verse 15, and a certain man found him, and behold, he was wandering in the field. And the man asked him, saying, what seek you? And he said, I seek my brethren. Tell me, I pray you, where they feed their flocks. And the man said, they are departed hence, for I heard them say, let us go to Dothan. And Jacob went after his brethren and found them in Dothan. Dothan, I think it's like 10 to 12 miles north of Shechem, and it had more water and grass than Shechem. So even though it was further away, apparently the brothers thought that it was worth the journey to, you know, find better pasture, and they left the area of Shechem. Verse 18, and when they saw him afar off, even before he came near unto them, because the area was flat, they could see him from a long ways off, they conspired against him to slay him. And so, you know, they were so angry at him, they hated him so much, and they could have been thinking, hey, he had this dream that we're going to worship, or you know, not worship him, excuse me, but we're going to bow down and serve him. He's going to rule over us. Well, he can't rule over us if he's dead. So they may have thought, well, we'll prove that that dream's not right. We'll kill him. And they said one to another, behold, this dreamer cometh. And I think as the margin says, master of dreams. So, you know, interpreter of dreams. It's not that he just had dreams, but he was able to interpret dreams. Come now, therefore, and let us slay him and cast him into some pit, and we will say some evil beast has devoured him, and we shall see what will become of his dreams. You know, notice that. His dream, you know, if we kill him, his dreams aren't going to come true. And Reuben heard it and delivered him out of their hands and said, let us not kill him. So Reuben, as the oldest son, takes a leadership position, you know, in a good way. And Reuben said unto them, shed no blood, but cast him into the pit that is in the wilderness, and lay no hand upon him, that he might rid him out of their hands to deliver him to his father again. So Reuben talks him into saying, well, let's not kill him ourselves. Let's just cast him into some pit and then let the wild animals or hunger or starvation kill him. But we won't have actual blood at our hands. And he talked him into that with the intention of coming back later and rescuing Joseph and returning him to his father. And it came to pass when Joseph was come unto his brethren that they stripped Joseph out of his coat of many colors, and again that was pieces that was upon him. So notice, you know, Joseph was wearing this very expensive and royal coat on his, you know, everyday activities, traveling through the land looking for his brethren. And the reason they would strip him of his coat is when they threw him in the pit is they didn't want somebody to find him and see this coat that indicated he was a wealthy or an important individual and then rescue him for a reward or something. So they wanted other people to think that he was just, you know, dirt common, ordinary person and not care about his welfare or survival. And they took him and cast him into a pit, and the pit was empty, it was dry, and there was no water in it. And they sat down to eat bread. They weren't very emotionally tied to Joseph. They threw him in the pit, ready to let him die, and let's go back to our business. I'm hungry. And they lifted up their eyes and looked, and behold, a company of Ishmaelites came from Gilead, and their camels bearing spicery and balm and myrrh, going to carry it down to Egypt. These are the descendants of Ishmael. Ishmael had 12 sons at an early age. You know, Esau didn't get married till he was 40, and Jacob didn't get married till he was 70, 75, 77. But Ishmael's mother took him a wife when he was only 18 or 20 years old. And a couple generations had gone by, and he had 12 sons. There could have been thousands. Some think up to, you know, 15,000 Ishmaelite descendants could have been born by then. So they could have been a nice, sizable group of people. And here comes a caravan of them, and they're traveling with other people for safety, because it mentions other people here later on. And Judah said unto his brethren, what profit is it if we slay our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother in our flesh, and his brethren were content. So here's the reputation of the Jews to this day, that they are financially adept. And not only that, but they'll, you know, cheat you out of your money or do anything to make a buck or dollar, as we say. And so, but, you know, God was guiding all of this. And again, you know, we've talked about this in the previous sermons. The whole purpose of this is to show God's power and glory in bringing Israel out of Egypt and the spiritual lessons that we are to learn from that. God is setting that up now as we read through this chapter. God wants to show his power through the 10 plagues of Egypt, and he wants to show his power in opening up the Red Sea, that he is God, and to bring Israel out of Egypt, and that represents for us spiritually sin, and that we need the help of God to come out of sin. All of that is to give glory to God. And so he's setting up the situation for to force Jacob and his family to go down to Egypt. And he's going to do that by causing 7 years of famine. But he's sending Joseph down to Egypt beforehand to collect and store grain during the 7 years of plenty. And it's all being done for a purpose, the purpose of glorifying God physically, for his protection and for bringing Israel out of Egypt and making them into a nation, and spiritually for the lessons that we should learn from those historical events, as Paul talks about in 1 Corinthians, the 10th chapter. So verse 28 then, and then they pass by the Midianites, merchantmen. So there were Ishmaelites and Midianites, and they drew and lifted up Joseph out of the pit and sold Joseph the Ishmaelite for 20 pieces of silver. Some think that's shekels. It's not worth very much money. It's almost like selling him in this day and age for like $20. Not much at all. And they sold Joseph to the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver, and they brought Joseph into Egypt. And Reuben returned unto the pit, and behold, Joseph was not in the pit, and he rent his clothes. And he returned unto his brethren and said, "The child is not, and I, whether shall I go?" You know, he was the firstborn. He was responsible, the leader among the brothers. And he says, you know, I'm responsible for, as the firstborn, for the welfare of us out here. And what am I going to say to our father about Joseph? And they took Joseph's coat. Notice when they killed him, they didn't, or not killed him, when they sold him, they kept the coat. And killed a kid of the goats and dipped the coat in the blood. And they sent the coat of many colors, or many pieces, and brought it to their father. Notice they didn't do it personally, but they, well, maybe one of them went, or they sent it by a messenger, and said, "This have we found. Know now whether it be your son's coat or no." And he knew it, and said, "This is my son's coat. An evil beast has devoured him. Joseph is without doubt rent in pieces." And Jacob rent his clothes, and put sackcloth upon his loins, and mourned for his son many days. And all his sons and all his daughters rose up to comfort him. Now, we talked about this before. Some think that it means that Jacob had more than one daughter, Diana, but they're not mentioned, except for Diana, because of the experience he had. Others think that the word daughters means a general term, daughters and daughters-in-laws. It's just not known for sure. I kind of lean toward that Jacob only had one daughter, and that this means daughters and daughters-in-laws rose up to comfort him. But he refused to be comforted. He said, "For I will go down to the grave unto my son's mourning." Thus his father wept for him. Yeah. What would it have been like? How calloused were the rest of the 10 brothers? They had to live with that day in and day out, knowing that their father was mourning for the son that he loved the most. You know, maybe they didn't care, but that had to eat away at them to some extent. And, after the years go by, Yes, you can get calloused and forget about it and go about your daily lives, but this had to bother them for a long, long time. And then they were reminded of it. You know, in Egypt, they kind of said, we're in trouble because of what we did to Joseph, you know, many years ago. Joseph was 17 years old when he was sold into Egypt, and we'll go over this later. I think he's 30 years old when he's put in charge, second in command in Egypt, and then, of course, the 6 years of famine go by, or plenty go by, and then a year or two of famine before they come down there, so that would be 12 plus 6 is 18. You know, it would be like 20 years before they see Joseph again. 20 years go by. 20 years, Jacob, you know, approximately, Jacob thinks Joseph is dead. And 20 years, his brothers, you know, live this lie. And, yes, you do get used to it. And the last verse here, and the Midianites sold him unto Egypt, unto Potiphar, an officer of the Pharaoh's, and the captain of the guard. Officer there, we see in the margin, means eunuch. And some think that he may have been a literal eunuch, even though he had a wife. They said it was common for eunuchs to have wives. And some think, well, that's one of the reasons why the wife of Potiphar made advances on Joseph, was because she wasn't getting any marital relationships from her husband because he was a eunuch. But eunuch can also mean just someone in authority, in a position of power. So he may or not have been a physical eunuch. We don't really know whether he was a physical eunuch or not. He was the captain of the guard. That meant he was the captain of the bodyguards. He was responsible for the protection of the Pharaoh. And if the Pharaoh wanted somebody killed, then that was Potiphar's responsibility, was to, you know, not only to protect the Pharaoh, but to destroy his enemies, as Pharaoh determined. All right, that ends chapter 37. Next chapter, we kind of take a break from the story of Joseph. We get back to the story of Joseph in chapter 39. And chapter 38 goes through the story of Judah and his family and the problems that they have. And we'll cover that next time.